All right. So, yeah, picking up, we'll just do a little bit of a review here. So goal for today, we're going to wrap up Judges and then hopefully get into Ruth a little bit. Not probably too far into Ruth, but we'll try. And so, yeah, your packets are slimmer because, again, we're slowing down a little bit. Don't worry. Yeah, I'm not slacking off on you guys. But, yeah, we're kind of slowing down a little bit to not quite go quite as warp speed through these books and passages. And so taking our time a little bit here is kind of what's happening. And so, again, just kind of reviewing here of where we're at in the book of Judges. So we talked about Joshua a few weeks ago, and then we've been covering Judges the last couple times. And last week we wrapped up kind of talking about the judges themselves. And so we're going to be getting into the end of Judges tonight. But just, again, context of the book of Judges as a whole. Again, we're developing that theme of the God who preserves his nation. That's really that theme of Judges. And really that kind of point of preserving. God has a purpose in that. And that's so that Israel will get a king. And as well as he's also showing the need for a king. And so that's really kind of his purpose in preserving Israel as a nation, is he's setting the stage for a king so that they actually will get a king. Okay, like we saw when we studied the Torah, there's this promise of Genesis 3:15, the seed, and then Genesis 49:10, that a king is going to come to bring peace, all this. And so God is preserving the nation so that that person actually comes, but then he's also establishing the need for the king. Okay, and so he's showing why Israel actually needs one as well. And so we saw that starting out in the prologue there, the kind of crisis begins, where, again, we just saw in that those first few chapters that Israel fails on kind of the physical and spiritual level. They fail on the physical level of failing to conquer the land. They don't continue to move forward in that. They fail in that way. But then they also fail on the spiritual level, where it also talks about that they went after other gods. They were not faithful to the Lord and all that. And they started going after the gods of the nations and everything. And then that's where we also saw kind of like our cycle, right? Of the people going over to idolatry. God punishes them. They cry out. God raises up a deliverer. They deliver. They have rest for a little bit. The judge dies. And then the cycle repeats, right? They go right back to it. And so then we had our crisis of leadership. And so we saw in the kind of main portion of Judges, with the namesake of the book, all the judges that we looked at. And we saw that kind of that main point that God delivers his flawed people by flawed people. Okay, and so Israel is messed up, but the leadership is too. And that's what we saw that, especially this last week where we got into some of the guys of like Gideon and Jephthah and Samson. We really saw they're not great guys. Okay, they did a lot of terrible things actually. And so you see through that, that none of these judges were like the right leader. Okay, and again, this was pointing to the need of a king. And so you need a king. You need someone who can unite the nation, someone who is a godly, righteous, just leader. You need all that. And that's what we were seeing the stage kind of set. All right, and so then that brings us to where we're going to pick up today, which is in chapter 17 of Judges. And your point there is we're on the epilogue, okay, the epilogue. And so the crisis of Israel. And so the main point of these chapters, kind of the end of Judges here, is to show that the people of Israel show the need for a king. Okay, the people of Israel show the need for a king. And so we just, again, as I just said, like we just got done showing the crisis of leadership and how the leadership of Israel was so messed up, which pointed to the need of the right leadership, which is the true king. But what we see in this last part of Judges is that not only is the leadership messed up, but the nation itself is messed up. And kind of put another way, it's not as if like the only issue is the leadership and, oh, well, if you just have the right leader, everything's fine. It's, no, like you do need the right leader, but the nation itself needs kind of change. They are wicked. They are evil. And so what this shows is that the true king that you need is going to have to be more than just like a good political leader or like a military leader. that he is going to have to actually reform the nation, okay, is what you're going to have to see, right? So for the true king, the right leader they need is not only going to work on like a physical level of just, oh yeah, we just need a military leader and that's all good, or we need a great politician, that's good. No, you need someone who can actually reform the hearts of the people, okay? Because as we're going to see, they're messed up. Okay, they're messed up, they're wicked, and that's really where we're going to see the state of the nation. And just like to prepare you, right? Like if you haven't read through Judges, all that, like it gets really dark, all right? It gets very dark at the end of Judges, and you just see how bad Israel has gotten during this time. And it just screams to the fact that you need a king. You need a king, because without a king, the people are crazy and they're completely wicked, okay? All right, and so then we're going to see this with kind of two main events here recorded in this epilogue. The first covering chapters 17 and 18, and then the second in 19 through 21. And so you can essentially divide these up like in a sense of kind of this first event in chapters 17 and 18 is going to show kind of the religious failure of Israel. And then the second will be showing the moral failure of Israel. And obviously there's some overlap in there, right? There's moral failure in the religious as well, but there's just more religious focus in 17 and 18, and then 19 through 21 is just more moral. It's very bad, all right? So we'll get into it. All right, so the first one here, the religious failure of Israel, chapters 17 and 18. I don't have my PowerPoint here, but hopefully you can keep track. There's not too many points this time, so we're not flying through, so... All right, so chapter 17, so the religious failure of Israel. And really, you get a glimpse into kind of the complete apostasy of the nation and how bad it was, right? They have turned from the Lord in even a religious way as well, okay? And so in chapter 17, we are introduced to a man in the hill country of Ephraim named Micah, okay? And we kind of pick up partway, like it almost seems like in the middle of a story here where we pick up with this conversation that he's having with his mother. And he starts this conversation referencing some money that had been stolen from her in the past. And so kind of like, hey mom, remember that like 1,100 pieces of silver that were stolen from you? Okay, he starts kind of talking about this. And just to put this into context a little bit here, of this 1,100 pieces of silver, that's more than just like $1,100 or something like for us. I mean, that'd still be a lot of money. If someone stole $1,100 from you, I'm sure you wouldn't be very happy about that. But what some people estimate this 1,100 pieces of silver could be equivalent kind of today from anywhere from the range of like $750,000 to like $6 million. Okay, it's kind of that range of how much this would be worth. So it's a significant chunk of change, right? And so, like again, I'm sure if you would have millions of dollars stolen from you, you'd be pretty upset, right? And that's why he even mentions that she uttered a curse on the one who stole this money, okay? Like, and that's what he says. Like, kind of remember that money you had taken from you about which you uttered a curse? And so she's obviously upset. She's not happy that someone took this. And then what does he do, right? He confesses that he was the one who stole it, okay? He was the one who stole it, and he kind of restores the money to her. And so now I'm sure you can put yourselves kind of like in the position of each person, okay, where I don't know if, how would your parents have responded if you stole millions of dollars from them? Probably not well, right? You probably got in trouble for much smaller things and all that. And so you'd be pretty scared with all that. Or if you flip it around and you're the parent, if your kid stole millions of dollars for you, would you just be like, no big deal, right? Like, that's fine. Like, no, that's significant. You would be pretty frustrated. You'd be pretty angry with all this. But then notice, how does Micah's mother respond in verse 2?
She's happy about it.
Yeah, she says, blessed be my son, right? She blesses her son for this. And so she, like, the one that she invoked, like, a curse on, essentially, she's now blessing him, okay? And again, you just see kind of how messed up this is, right? Because last I checked the Ten Commandments, what's one of them? You're not supposed to what? Steal, right? Like, and she's saying like, oh, bless you, my son. Like, you're such a good boy, or like, you're such a good son. Stealing from me, then giving it back, apparently, when she found out I was cursing the one who stole it. And so what is she kind of doing here, right? She's essentially calling evil good, right? She's calling evil good. She's twisting things. And again, this shouldn't come as too much a surprise for us in the period of the judges, because if you remember, everyone does what is right in what? Their own eyes, right? Their own eyes. And so you even have people calling evil good. But don't worry, it gets worse, right? Like, that's just, you think like, oh, that's bad enough. But no, it gets far worse, okay? Because notice what she does with the returned silver. She says that she will dedicate it to the Lord, which you're like, well, that's good. That's a good thing to dedicate to the Lord. And that word for dedicate is that kind of same root word for like something that is holy. So something that is set apart for God. It's holy, it's pure, all this. But then notice, what does she actually do with this? How does she dedicate this money to the Lord?
She makes an image.
Yeah, she makes an idol out of it. You're like, what? Like, I'm going to dedicate it, this pure, holy dedication to the Lord, and I'm going to make an idol, right? Which again, we're just breaking Ten Commandments left and right. You're not supposed to make a carved image or anything like that. And it's interesting because even like this exact combination of words, like this, how it says like a carved image and metal image, that kind of combination of words was last kind of seen in the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 27. And it mentions like the one who makes a carved or metal image will be cursed, okay? And really, and in that context, that's like the instruction where the Levites are supposed to like declare these things and all the nation is supposed to say like, amen, like, yeah, for sure, like, that's bad. And so, again, you just have this complete twisting here to where they believe what they're doing is right when in reality they're completely sinning and making abomination to the Lord. Everything is just so twisted. It's so backwards, okay? And he keeps going. So Micah just, so he takes the idol, they make this thing right. He also makes a shrine and an ephod and even ordains one of his sons as a priest, okay? And so essentially Micah is setting up his own priesthood, which again goes against what God had commanded, okay? Like it was supposed to be the Levites, supposed to be all that, right? Like the specific people, and he's just like, well, I'm going to make my son a priest. This is awesome. And so he's really setting up like his own priesthood, his own religion, and everything, and he's just piling up violations left and right, okay? Just completely violating the law, all this. But again, don't miss, like in verse 6, how the narrator draws our attention back. What's kind of the reason for all this? It's because what? In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes, right? So he's drawing us back to this as a result of a lack of a king. You need a king. And you need the right king, okay? You need the right king as well. All right, but then in verse 7, we're introduced to a new person kind of wandering around here looking for a place to settle. And it tells us that he's from Bethlehem in Judea, among the clan of Judah. But most significantly, he's a what? A Levite, okay? He's a Levite. And if you remember like our time in the Torah and everything, the Levites were not given like a specific territory at large, but they were given cities. Okay. There's like the Levitical cities that were scattered around in all the other tribes, and kind of their purpose was to be there to, try to help Israel cultivate a life of worship. They were supposed to help that and kind of get that going. And so they were supposed to live in these specific cities. Okay. But what do you have here? You have this Levite kind of wandering around looking for a place to settle. And even worse, like Bethlehem, it says like he's from there. That wasn't a Levitical city, right? So he wasn't living where he's supposed to live. And now he's wandering looking for a place to live. And so this isn't good on like the Levite's end of like he should have been where he was supposed to be. But it also could be an indication that Like, the Israelites were not actually taking care of the Levites, right? Like, that was part of the thing. They were supposed to help the Levites out, care for them, support them, and maybe they weren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. And so you have Levites kind of wandering around like, hey, I need food, I need shelter, like all these things. But all around, not a great situation. But as he's wandering around, you have Micah notice him, and what's he do? What does Micah do?
He invites him to stay with him.
Yeah, he recruits him, right? He recruits him to what? Be a priest for his apostate religion, right? He's like, oh, Levi, this is awesome. This is an upgrade here. And it's like, well, what's wrong with this? Like, well, a lot of things are wrong with this. But if you remember, in our survey of the Torah, were all Levites supposed to be priests? No, right? It's like that thing where, like, all priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests, that kind of a thing. And in fact, if you remember, again, back in, like, Numbers and stuff, the last time certain Levites tried to become priests, did that end well for them? That is what we call, like, Korah's rebellion, where, the earth ended up swallowing up people, and then the people offering the censers all got fried as well, right? And so that didn't go well last time people tried to, like, make a Levite a priest that wasn't supposed to be. But again, you see that in Judges, like, they don't care, right? It's all twisted. It's all twisted here. And so you have this guy Micah making this Levite a priest when he wasn't supposed to be. And again, it's for this kind of apostate religion he's doing. And to make it all worse, notice what Micah says in verse 13. What's he say? Yeah, he says, now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as a priest. Just so backward, right? His thinking is so twisted. And again, it's everyone does what is right in his own eyes, right? To where he could look at this situation and you could just check off over and over, like, well, that violates the law, that violates the law, that violates the law, right? Like, and he could look at this whole situation and say, now Yahweh will bless me, right? Yahweh will prosper me because of all this. And it's just, man, you are just so backwards, right? You're so twisted here. All right. And that takes us into chapter 18, where, again, we get another reminder at the start there. There's no king in Israel, and so this is, again, all rooted and linked to the reality that they need a king. And you have in chapter 18 the tribe of Dan come on the scene here, okay? And notice it says that they are looking for a place to dwell. In verse 1 it says, the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in, for until then no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. And at first glance, you might think, like, oh, that's weird. Okay, like, they're waiting for their inheritance or something like that. But what this is actually referred to, that kind of phrase there, for until then, no inheritance among the tribes had fallen to them. You could kind of take that more as, like, the land hasn't fallen to them. Because if you look in the context of, like, even Judges or Joshua, what? They had land appointed to them, right? They had land appointed to them. But if you look back at Judges, like chapter 1, it talks about how Dan failed to conquer the land. Okay, that the, I think it was the Amorites, they ended up kind of pushing Dan up into the hills, that they couldn't succeed in conquering the land. And so when it mentions that no inheritance had fallen to them, it's not as if, like, they haven't received, like, oh, what land are we getting yet? But rather, it was pointing to the fact that they had not actually conquered the land, right, that they had received. It hadn't fallen to them in that sense, okay? But again, you ask the question of, like, well, why didn't the land come into their possession? And if you remember, we established this truth back in Joshua a few weeks ago, where the failure or success of the Israelites depended on what? You guys remember?
Faithfulness.
Yeah, faithfulness, obedience. Right? It didn't depend on military might, didn't depend on certain strategies or the strength of their enemies or whatever it was. It was all dependent upon obedience. If you obeyed God, you had success. If you disobeyed God, you had failure. And so due to their disobedience, Dan has not been able to come to full possession of their allotted land. That's what's going on here. And so they're looking for a place to dwell, right? And so not a great situation for this tribe to be in. And so notice kind of what they're doing in this chapter. Instead of repenting and turning to the Lord in order to get his help in conquering the land, they begin, what do? They're like, let's go find another place, right? Let's go find another place to dwell. Maybe there's an easier place to conquer. Forget this area that God had ordained for us. Let's go somewhere else. And so they send out spies to find a different place to move to, okay? And again, this goes against what God is calling to. God had assigned them to a specific spot. He determined all these tribes were to be in a specific spot. They were supposed to be content in the land that he had given them. But the tribe of Dan instead tries to find this new location for themselves. Which again, now you have a whole tribe doing what? What is right in their own eyes, right? It's like, well, this sounds much better. We don't want to deal with those Amorites. That was hard. Let's go find an easier people to conquer, right? And all that. So these spies go out into the land to search for a new location. And while they're searching, they come across the Levite who was living in the house of Micah. Okay, it says like they remembered his voice or they recognized his voice and everything. And they kind of ask like, well, what are you doing here? And he kind of explains what's going on. And then interestingly enough, in verse 5, they actually ask him to inquire of God, right, for them to know like whether their journey will be successful and all that. And it's probably fitting they don't use the name Yahweh, just kind of the generic name for God here. But then you have the Levite's response, which is kind of vague. Yeah, it's pretty vague. It's just like, yeah, go in peace. The journey in which you go on is under the eye of the Lord. And you're kind of, when you actually stop and think about that, you're like, is it under the eye of the Lord in a good way or a bad way? Right? Like, you don't know, right? Like, it's just a vague kind of statement that he makes here. And again, especially since like, and it, the reality is like, he probably didn't actually inquire of Yahweh, right? Because God wouldn't actually like endorse this sort of disobedience on many levels of not only this priest, but also Dan doing what they're doing. But these guys leave, so the spies leave. They go and find the town of Laish up in like the northern part of Israel. And they find like, oh, it's like a peaceful place, has like bountiful supplies, all that. And the people, it says they're like an unsuspecting people. So we could take them down easy, right? Those would be nice. And they report back. They go back to their tribe. They give the report like, hey, this is a good place. These people seem like we can conquer them. They seem pretty easy to destroy and all that. But as they're on their way to Laish, they stop by the house of Micah again. And what do they end up doing? They end up convincing the Levite to kind of come and join them, right? And they actually steal like the idol, the ephod, all that stuff. And then the Levite's like, hey, what are you guys doing? And they're kind of like, hey, don't talk about it. Just come join us, right? Like, and they convince him with kind of the argument of, would you rather be a priest of just one guy's house or would you rather be a priest of a whole tribe? And notice, like it says in verse 20, and the priest's heart was glad, right? He's like, oh, promotion, right? Like, this is awesome. Like, everything keeps coming up me, right? Like, I got upgraded to a priest and now I'm a priest of a tribe. Like, this is just awesome. Okay? And so, again, terrible situation. So they all leave. But then, what? Micah finds out all his stuff's gone. His priest's gone. Is he happy about that? No. So he kind of rallies some people. They go and confront the tribe of Dan. But that's, again, when you actually stop and think about that, isn't that kind of ironic of why is he mad? Because someone, what? Stole from him. Which, what did he do before?
He stole,
right? Like, and so it's only bad when it's like impacting you, right? Like, and so he's upset, and he goes and confronts the tribe of Dan, and they essentially tell him like, "Hey, go home, else we'll kill you," right? Like, that's kind of summary there of what it is. And once he realizes, yeah, they seem too much for me, like I can't do anything about this, he returns home. and all that. And then the tribe Dan continues on with their new idol, their new apostate priest, and they go and conquer the city of Laish and take it over, and they rename it the city of Dan on behalf of their ancestor, and they set up their idol and all that, okay? And so they are just, again, tearing down all that God has established and are in complete apostasy, okay? Like, just this whole tribe is just backwards as well, okay? But then, don't miss the last part of this story, okay? So the whole time, we've just been kind of going along here with this kind of nameless Levi. I just refer to him as like a Levi who's kind of been around and stuff. And then finally at the end, we get a glimpse into like who he is, okay? Who is this Levi here? And we say like, oh, and his name is Jonathan, okay? And you're like, well, that's nice, but why is that important? But if you keep reading in verse 30, so it's Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of who?
Moses.
Right? The son of Moses. And so the Levite who becomes this apostate priest is the grandson of Moses. And some translations might say Manasseh instead of Moses. And that's because like the scribes kind of inserted like a little superscript N there because they just couldn't bear the thought that this was the grandson of Moses. So they kind of like, oh, let's change it to Manasseh, right? Like, so some manuscripts kind of say that. And so some translations might say that, but in reality, it's Moses, right? That's what it is. It's Moses. And so this is how bad it has gotten, right? Because if you remember, Moses is the one who like gave all these laws, right? He was that mediator between God and the people. And so he gave all these laws to the nation of Israel, and his grandson essentially just undoes all of it. Okay, undoes all of it. And if you think about too, if you think about the reality too, that like this is happening with Moses' grandson, likely indicates that this event is taking place relatively early on in the time period of the Judges. Okay, like yes, it's at the end of the book of Judges, but chronologically probably happening earlier, right? Because again, if you think of just your grandson or your grandparents, we're not talking like hundreds of years, right? We're talking a relatively short period of time, okay? And so what this shows you is that in such a short amount of time, Israel is totally reversed, and reversed to the extent that Moses' grandson is undoing all that Moses had established. That's how bad it is, right? It's just a bad situation here. And so again, you need a king. But again, not just any king, but a king that can actually reform the nation as well. Okay, that's what's going on here. All right. And then that takes us into chapter 19. And we're going to look at the moral failure of Israel. So we saw again, you can see those elements of the religious failure, right? Because it's having to do with like the idols, the priesthood, all that stuff, right? And how it's just the apostasy all over, rejecting God's commands, all that. But then now we have kind of this moral failure of Israel, where again, we see the complete wickedness on display here, right? The depths of their wickedness is on display. And just the nation is just morally corrupt, right? That's what they are. And again, we get this glimpse into this in a very dark situation. All right, and so we pick up chapter 19. This next account also involves a Levite. Probably not the same one, okay? Hopefully not, right? But probably not the same one. And we find out that his concubine has run away and returned to her father's house in Bethlehem. So again, we see Bethlehem coming up a couple times, and not in the best of stories. But eventually, the Levite goes to bring her back home. And on their way back home, it gets dark and they need to find a place to stay. And on their way, they're near the city of Jebus, which is eventually becomes Jerusalem. But at that time, that's where like the Jebusites still like live there and all everything. And so they're near there. And the Levite servant suggests like, hey, it's getting dark. We should stay in Jebus. All right, like, let's just stay here. And do you remember kind of the response of the Levite, what's he kind of say? So you go along with that? Not quite, right? He says, verse 12, we will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel. Right? Like, so he's like, I'm not staying in a place of these Jebusites, these foreigners. Like, I'm not going to stay there. Let's continue on to, it says, like, to Gibeah. All right, to Gibeah. And stay there since that's an Israelite city. So that's his whole thing is, well, I don't want to trust these foreigners. Let's go to Gibeah instead. And so as they're there, they're kind of in the town square area waiting for someone to kind of show some hospitality, let them stay with them. And eventually, this old man shows them hospitality, and they brings them in, provides food, all this stuff. Everything seems like it's going fine until, like, verse 22, it talks about the men of the city of Gibeah surround the house and demand the old man to hand over the Levite so that they may know him. And again, this is not knowing in the sense of, oh, we just want to meet him, right? This is that euphemism for sexual relations, okay? And so they want to have sexual relations with this Levite, okay? And the old man refuses, and instead he offers up his daughter and the Levite's concubine, which you're like, well, that's not good. That's not a good substitute there. But the men of Gibeah refuse. They want the Levite, and they're getting angry, all that stuff, right? And eventually, the Levite seizes his concubine and forces her out to the men of Gibeah. Okay, and essentially they rape and abuse her all night, right? It's absolutely terrible. It's sick. And really one of the darkest, I think, accounts in, like, the Old Testament, like, in Scripture, I think, is this is, like, for me at least, one of those darkest things. But when you hear this event, what does this account remind you of? Yeah, Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah, right? If you remember that account, back in Genesis, where Lot is visited by the angels of the Lord, right? Like, and the men of Sodom surround the house, and it's the same thing, like, bring them out so we may know them. It's that same kind of account. And if you compare those two accounts, the similarities are very stark, okay? And that's because that's the narrator's point. That's the author's point here, is to make that connection that Israel has become Sodom and Gomorrah. Right? They've become Sodom and Gomorrah. That's how bad and extremely wicked they are. That in their mind, one of, like, the worst places, like, they've become just like them. Okay? And so you need a king who can reform the people. Right? You need a king who can reform the people. And as morning comes, the Levite goes out and finds his concubine lying near the entrance of the house. And in such a cold and callous way, what, he just says, like, get up, let's go, right? That's what he says. It's terrible. But she doesn't respond because she's dead, right? She's dead. She died through all that. And so this is another kind of weird situation, right? Like, so he brings her back home, and do you remember what he ends up doing with her? Yeah, he cuts her up into 12 pieces and kind of sends out these 12 pieces to all the tribes of Israel, okay? And again, even on a side note, like, touching dead bodies, that makes you, like, unclean, and Levites aren't supposed to be unclean, but in the process, he's making himself unclean. So again, violations of law all over the place, right? People are just piling it up, but he sends out these pieces, and it provokes the rest of the tribes to gather to deal with this terrible situation, right? It kind of awakens them to, like, this is messed up. We need to deal with this, okay? And that leads into chapter 20. But before getting into chapter 20, if you remember back in the introduction to Judges, I had mentioned this, like, kind of in the historical context, these, like, Amarna letters, right? That were, like, the correspondence between various, like, nations in or near the land of Canaan with Egypt during that time. Do you guys remember that? And in one of those letters, we got, like, a glimpse into how bad the situation was in the land of Israel at that time, because one person, like, was writing from one of the northern nations. He was writing to Egypt essentially saying, like, hey, I need to do some business in Egypt. I need you to send me a military escort to make it through this land. And you're like, that's how bad it was. And when you see the account of this, you can understand, yeah, you need a military escort, right? Even their own Israelites, they attacked and did something terrible and brutal to. And so imagine with like other people, okay? And so you see how terrible it is. And so again, it's all backwards, because what was Israel supposed to be? They were supposed to be a light to the nations. They were supposed to be an example to those around them. But instead they become what? Just such a dark place that people are like, we can't travel through there without a military escort. I don't want to go down there, right? Like, that's not putting God on display, right? It's just backwards, okay? All right, so then in chapter 20, we see all the tribes gather together, and they send word to the leaders of Benjamin to hand over the guilty men at Gibeah so that they can be put to death for this terrible crime and therefore, like, purge the wickedness from Israel, which, yeah, like, that sounds pretty fair, right? Like, that sounds what you're kind of supposed to do. Like, these guys did a terrible, horrible crime that deserved death, and so they're kind of like, hey, we need to do this. And so on the surface, you're like, great, that sounds good. Okay, but how does Benjamin respond? How do the leaders respond? They kind of agree with this? What do you think? The Benjaminites, do they hand over the people? No, they don't. All right. So they don't, right? They refuse. They're like, we're not going to hand over these people. And in fact, instead of like, and on top of that, like, we just want to fight you instead, right? Like, so they decide, right? Like, instead of handing over these people, they're going to defend them. And not only just defend them of like, we're not going to hand over, it's like, they're actually going to go to war over this, right? And it's terrible, right? And it's even just crazier, like, even just on the surface of Benjamin. Like, Benjamin musters about, like, 26,000 men to fight this battle. And the rest of these tribes, they have, like, 400,000. Okay? So, just even on the surface, you're like, that's crazy. Right? Like, who would fight this battle anyways of just 26,000 on 400,000? That's not smart. That's pretty foolish and dumb. But then it's not even for, like, a righteous cause. It's for a very wicked cause of, hey, we're going to defend these people that did this atrocious, abominable thing. Okay? And so Benjamin is just willing to go vastly against the odds in order to defend these wicked men. It's terrible. And it's interesting here that, so this war is going to happen. So again, now we have civil war kind of essentially breaking out in Israel. So again, not good. The nation is messed up. All of that. But it's interesting, if you notice in verse 18, what do the tribes of Israel actually do? Yeah, they actually inquire of the Lord, which is kind of interesting. Like, oh, that's good, I guess, for them. And they ask the Lord of, like, who should go up first? Which that's kind of interesting, because they don't really ask, like, should we do this? They just ask, like, oh, yeah, we're doing this. Like, who goes up first, right? Kind of a thing. And the Lord replies, like, Judah should. And what's interesting about that is that in chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, if you like, look back at that real quick, keep a finger here. But in those, in chapter 1 of Judges, it says, after the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? The Lord said, Judah shall go up. Okay? Sound familiar? Right? It's almost like that same kind of thing, right? And again, the idea here is, at the beginning of Judges, this was in context of they're waging this holy war against the Canaanites and all that. But then now, what? They are at war against the tribe of Benjamin. And really, Benjamin, by their wicked actions, have shown themselves to be Canaanites as well, right? That's like kind of what the point is, right? They're acting just like the Canaanites, and so it's almost happening just like at the beginning of Judges here. But the result is kind of interesting because they go and attack Benjamin, and do you remember what happens? First time they attack, doesn't go well for them, right? Benjamin actually defeats them, and defeats them pretty badly, actually, which is crazy. Like, so the tribes of Israel, they lose 22,000 men. Okay, it doesn't recount if Benjamin lost anyone, but we know 22,000 men. So that's a lot of people, and so Benjamin kind of wins, okay, for that first battle. And so that's pretty shocking, and Israel's kind of dismayed, but they're like, okay, like, they inquire of the Lord again, should we go attack again? So at least they're asking a better question this time, or should we attack? And God says, what? Yeah, go attack. And what happens the second time? They get defeated again, okay? They lose even more people. And right there, you're just like, wait, what? Like, I thought God said to go attack. Like, why are they not succeeding? I mean, first you get a glimpse of, again, if you have that comparison of the beginning of Judges to this last part, even that first thing, at the beginning of Judges, it's interesting that God says, like the Lord said, Judah shall go up, behold, I have given the land into his hand, right? Whereas that part's kind of missing in this last part, Judges, like, yeah, Judah go up, but he makes no comment of like, I've given it into your hand, right? Like, just go for it. And probably what this is showing, right, is to open the eyes of the Israelites that they're wicked just like Benjamin, right? They're wicked just like Benjamin, okay? They have been unfaithful. They've been doing things right in their own eyes, as we've seen, right? Like, they're no better in that sense. And this seems to be kind of confirmed, right? Because what do they finally do after this, like, second defeat? When they come to the Lord, it says they came before the Lord and fasted and offered sacrifices, right? They essentially what? They repented, right? They repented. They offered the sacrifice. They turned to the Lord, actually. And it is at that point, it's only after that, that they get this guarantee from the Lord that you'll be successful, right? That they'll be successful. Because notice that in verse 28, and the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I'll give them into your hand, right? Therefore, there he finally does give that indication, I'll give them into your hand, go for it, right? All that. So they go against Benjamin a third time, and this time they're successful, right? They use kind of a play out of Joshua's book, setting an ambush, all that stuff. But in this process, do they just get kind of revenge on the men of Gibeah, Benjamin? No, like they go beyond that, right? And so what they end up doing, right, like they go way too far where they defeat Benjamin's army and then they end up attacking like all the cities of Benjamin and just killing everyone essentially to the point where there's just 600 men left in the tribe. Like, wow, like what happened? And so they essentially bring the tribe of Benjamin like on the edge of extinction, right? Like they're about to like just kind of die out. They just have 600 guys. That's not gonna survive, right? Like that's just gonna die with them. Okay, there's no women. Like all the women are dead. Like all this, right? And so, like, why would that be an issue? Well, God's made promises to the tribe of Benjamin. So if they kind of cease to exist, that's not good. Okay, so God's promises won't be fulfilled. All that. So not a good situation. And so even when Israel tries to do something good, like hold the wicked accountable and purge kind of the evil from their midst, they still kind of find a way to mess it up, right? They still find a way to mess it up and they cross the line into sinful behavior, okay? Where again, Benjamin wasn't like innocent in all this, right? They're terrible too. But what you see here is even when they're trying to do this like good thing, they still end up crossing the line, right? And so they didn't have to go wipe out all the nation, right? They didn't have to do that, but they did, okay? All right. Let's see. Let's finish this out, and then we'll take a little break. So chapter 21. In chapter 21, we find out to make matters even worse in this whole situation is that we find a little piece of information that in their preparations for battle against the people of Benjamin, the people of Israel had made a vow. Okay, they made a vow, which as we've seen in Judges, are vows working very well so far? No, not very good, right? We saw with Jephthah that did not work out very well. But so what was this vow? They vowed that no one would give their daughter in marriage to Benjamin. That was their vow. Okay, that cursed be that one, right? Like who gives his daughter to a Benjaminite for marriage. And so, well, that's a predicament, right? Because what do you have now? Benjamin only has 600 men left, and the other tribes have vowed not to give any of their daughters him in marriage. And they're not supposed to marry women from the foreign nations. So what do you do, right? Like, what do you do? They're going to die out, right? They can't repopulate. This is bad. Okay, this is bad. And so we see the consequences of their foolish actions. But notice, once again, even though they kind of weep over this and they're like sorrowful, they offer sacrifice for all that, but do they actually seek the Lord's advice in how to handle this? No. They don't actually go to the Lord to figure out how do we solve this issue, right? We've messed up. This is bad. How do we solve this? They don't do that. But instead, they once again kind of take things into their own hands. And I'm sure you can guess, do they go about this the best way? No, they don't. Okay, but let's look at how they try to go about this. And again, you just see time and time again, things just get worse, right? Violation after violation, right? So the first plan to get around the vow is to figure out if there were any like clans or tribes of the people who were not at that meeting where they made that vow. Okay, like, well, maybe someone didn't show up, right? Like, that'd be nice. And they figure out that no one from the town of Jabesh-Gilead had been at that meeting, and so they didn't make that vow. And, like, people joke about this, of like, that's why you always attend meetings, okay? It's the importance of attending meetings here and all that. But they figure out no one from Jabesh-Gilead made this vow, so they kind of get around their vow and get some women to be the wives for the men of Benjamin. But how do they go about doing this? Do they go to the people of Jabesh-Gilead and explain the situation and say, hey, this is our situation. Benjamin's like dying out. We made this vow. You guys didn't make this vow. Like, can we like work something out? Is that what they kind of do? No, right? That's not what they do. What they do instead, like that would make too much sense. But instead, what they do is they send an army of 12,000 men and they go and wipe out all the inhabitants of the Jabesh-Gilead, except for the virgin women, right? So they just wipe out everyone, except for the virgin women. And then they, so essentially, like you think about, right? Like they kill all these girls, like families and all that, and then take them to be the wives of these Benjaminites. And so they're just, again, switching one sin for another, right? This is terrible. But then does this even fully solve the problem? No, because they only got like 400 women from that, and they had 600 men. So, oh man, we're like 200 short, okay? So again, not a good solution first off. So then, do they go to the Lord for advice? Of course not, right? They do not. They just develop another terrible plan, and basically what they end up doing is trying to find like another loophole in their vow, and the loophole they end up going with is essentially, well, we vowed that if anyone like gave their daughter to a Benjaminite like in marriage, that would be like worthy of a curse, all that. But we didn't say anything about kidnapping, right? Like, so if we took them by force, they didn't give them, we just took them, we'll be in the clear. And that's what they go with, right? That's what they actually do, is they devise this plan that apparently there's like this yearly feast in the town of Shiloh. And during that feast, some of the daughters of the people of Shiloh would go out and dance during it. And so they developed this plan of like, hey, go hide, wait kind of an ambush. And when these daughters come out to dance and stuff, just go take the one you want and go back to your town in Benjamin. And if the leaders kind of come and ask about it, we'll say, hey, it's okay. You didn't give them. They kidnapped them. Everything's cool, right? Yeah, except for the daughter who just got kidnapped and the family. Like, it's just, again, it's terrible. Okay, and again, this is straight kidnapping. And if you look back at the law, Exodus 21, what's the punishment for kidnapping someone? Death, right? To put them to death. And so they're just, again, this was a serious crime, and they're just replacing one sin for another. They're just stacking up over and over again all these rebellions against God and his commands. Okay, terrible. And that, and the book just kind of ends there, right? The book just kind of ends there with this sad event. But then also don't miss the very last verse in the book, right? The narrator wants to make sure that we don't miss the key in all of this. And so it reminds us of what? There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's exactly what we've seen from the people of Israel in these last few chapters of Judges. They had no concern for God's commands, but instead did whatever they felt was good in their eyes, and in the process, they often ended up calling like evil good, right? That's what they were doing. And so you see from all this that it's not only the leadership that's messed up, but the people themselves are really messed up, and this all points to the reality you need a king, and on top of that, you need the true king who can not only lead the nation, but who can also reform the hearts of the people, right? That's what you really need here. And that's what Judges is pointing us to, okay? And then as we come into Ruth, and we'll get that after a break, you start to see God heading that direction, okay? So we'll take a little break here, get a breather, and then we'll pick back up with a little bit of Ruth.